Today is February 24th, 2016. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today we have a couple of informational hearings and a work session. We're going to start off with the work session because I don't know how much longer we're going to have the senators. They graced their graced us with their presence today. It looks to be just briefly. So we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 4093 and turn it over to Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Subcommittee members. House Bill 4093 is relating to courthouses, and it authorizes circuit courts to impose a $5 surcharge on fines for parking violations and traffic offenses. The authorization is limited to counties that have a courthouse project that is approved for funding through the Oregon Courthouse Capital Construction Improvement Fund. This is a legislatively approved mechanism for supporting the costs of county courthouses with Article 11G bond proceeds. The surcharge may also be imposed only in situations where the County Board of Commissioners requests the surcharge and the Chief Justice approves. The surcharge revenues are dedicated to assisting the county in costs related to the construction of the courthouse. The revenues go directly to the county. They do not come to the state. One of the provisions in the bill, as it is before you today, is to place priority of collections in cases where only part of a fine or assessment is paid to the courthouse security funds. Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending that you approve the Dash 9 amendments. The Dash 9 amendments, their only impact is to change the priority so that the existing recipients of fine revenues, generally the state and city, or in some cases the county, will receive their portions of a partial fine payment before any of the surcharge payments are made.
All right, so do we have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the Dash A9 amendments to House Bill 4093A.
All right, Senator Shields has moved the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 4093A. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out how important this is, especially in the Multnomah County Courthouse. That's not part of my district, but I worked there for years and family working there for years. If there's an earthquake, that building would drop. It's 8 stories. There'd be an awful lot of people in there, and we need to do this. We also, besides the funding that's coming from the citations, we're going to need to have more money to get that done. And we need to have set up a system so we can go around the state and upgrade all the courthouses that need upgrading. These are important community centers, and they need our protection. So I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative Barker. Representative Wisnett.
I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a work group, I believe, in 2005 that looked at this issue, and I remember sitting next to Senator Burdick talking about it, and the need was great. 10 years ago, we knew it was great. Where a lot of people might argue, do we want to impose new fees on people who have committed some type of crime, and whether it be traffic crime or some other type of thing? The fact is, we have to have new money, and nobody has told me or come up with any other idea of to fund this in any other way that we'd get any more support than we do now. And what Jeff said about an 8-story building with maybe 1,000-plus people in it, if something was to happen there, it would be a real disaster, and we'd all be wondering, why didn't we act sooner? Unfortunately, I was born at Multnomah County.
No, that's a good thing.
And now I'm 300 miles south, and I may not ever be in that courthouse, but I would feel that I hadn't done my duty in protecting those people from Multnomah County.
Is there any further discussion? Any further discussion?
Just a quick comment, if I could. I agree with everything that's been said here, but I worked in the healthcare field almost 99% of the time up here, and I was been racing around reading bills real fast. I'm relieved to see that I had read this wrong. I thought the relating cause was relating to outhouses, and obviously it's courthouses, so I'm glad to vote for this.
Excellent. Representative Gorsuch.
I just want to echo what my colleagues have said. This is a very important thing to start moving on. And I know we've been working on some other courthouses around the state, and I want to see the county, Multnomah County, move forward, and also the other necessary courthouse improvements continue around the state. So this is going to be a long-term discussion.
It is.
And, you know, the $5 fee, maybe that's not the best way to go into the future, but it's a good start.
All right. Is there any further discussion? All right. Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, motion carries.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move House Bill 4093 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Yes, Senator Shields is moved House Bill 4093A as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Senator Shields?
Yes. Since this will potentially be my last public safety subcommittee ever, I would like to take the opportunity to say, now that we're rebuilding courthouses, the next thing we need to rebuild is judicial discretion in mandatory minimum sentencing cases. Oh.
Senator Shields is pandering to the audience. Is there any further discussion? All right, seeing no discussion, is there any objection to the motion? All right, seeing no objection, the motion carries. Senator Shields, would you like to carry this to full on the Senate side?
I would be honored to make the same speech.
And Representative Barker, would you be willing to carry this on the House floor?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 4093. We're going to open up an informational hearing, two of them, one on judicial compensation and the second one on public defense pay parity. And so we'll start by calling up Representative Olson and Representative Davis. And for the audience, we are starting with judicial compensation. Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. Appreciate this opportunity to come before you, especially with the stacked panel that we have here today. I mean, except for one member, all of you have been on judiciary at one time. Excuse me. I do want to kind of just talk a little bit about judicial compensation with you. I spent 29 years with the Oregon State Police. Five of those years were with the secondary interviewing and the hiring process for new applicants. I understand the importance of having recruitment. And I want to tie what my experience has been to that of what is needed behind the bench. It's extremely important to have someone there that is qualified, a quality individual. It's extremely important to have someone that knows how to make correct decisions because it impacts all of us. And sometimes, you know, we think that it's, well, from the public side, we think, well, it's only the criminal side of law. No, it goes deeper than that. It more than likely is more so on the civil side than it reaches out to the criminal side. And it's the civil side, through business law, that makes the world turn for us. So if you don't have a quality individual behind the bench, it makes it difficult for us to move forward as a society. Retention becomes an extremely important piece because that's how we felt, too, when I was with the agency, with state police. So is the case with the judges today. So as I share that with you, I really would like to have you strongly consider the package for them, for where they are, mainly because of the quality, the decision-making process for them, as well as retention. We did have a number of other members that were here from the legislative body, Representative Barton, Helm, and Leininger, that I would point out are all attorneys. We're here as well, but they had to leave. Also, Senator Johnson, Prezansky, and Roblin were planning on being here, too. So thank you.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis from House District 26. The fight in 26! It is a pleasure to be here and to see such a tremendous crowd who's joined us in support of judicial compensation. Many of you heard the testimony of a number of us judges and myself and others for House Bill 4145 in the House Judiciary Committee, which was referred down to Ways and Means. And I just want to reiterate some of that testimony about the need for a well-compensated and well-qualified judiciary in Oregon. The fact of the matter is that with increasing frequency, the judge is the lowest paid attorney in the courtroom in Oregon now. And depending on the metric you use and whether or not you account for cost of living, judges in Oregon are paid among the lowest. Even last session, the ranking was the lowest in the nation. I think we're still down about 45th in the country adjusting for our cost of living in Oregon. So there's pretty wide agreement that judges in Oregon are not compensated for the services they provide. And we could just leave this at compensation and it would be a worthy discussion. But I like to bring it to really a constitutional level, which is we are supposed to have three co-equal branches of government. And we've really added a fourth level to that, which is a very large administrative and executive branch through our administrative agencies. But in a time when we have one branch of the government, the executive and agency branches, growing tremendously with tens of thousands of employees compensated in many instances hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we have a legislature that all of us know can oftentimes has limited resources, limited staff, and limited resources of our own to perform our constitutional duties. And when we are also laying at the table judicial compensation, which by any reasonable metric is woefully low, I think we imperil our constitutional system of government in this state. We need three co-equal branches to work. And right now, with the compensation level that we have for judges, I think we threaten that. We threaten that with workload. We threaten that with the potential to recruit the most qualified attorneys and judges to the bench. And I think we threaten the public trust when we continue to underfund. The proposal in House Bill 4145, which I know is not directly under consideration here, was essentially to adopt the 2008 Public Officials Compensation Committee recommendation. Again, those numbers were from 2008. And the idea was to step up over a four budget cycle period compensation for judges with a $7,500 increase the first time, $7,500 the second time, $5,000 the third time, and a final $5,000 pay bump. So not asking the legislature or the public to make that leap immediately, but to do it in a scaled in and planned way so that we could work at it in our budgetary framework. Those of us on the dais here, of course, don't know what the plans are from the co-chairs and from those writing the budget. But we would request that we make a meaningful step towards that goal as proposed in House Bill 41 and 45, which was brought forward by the Chief Justice. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you both. And it looks like we have a couple of senators in our midst. Senators, would you like to come up and testify?
Since the House warmed it up.
And please tell us what fighting district you're from.
And in this corner.
Go ahead.
State Senator Floyd Przanowski, District 4, includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for allowing us to be part of the subcommittee discussions. I, too, want to give my support to the compensation package for the judges. And I believe Representative Davis has really laid out a framework that we should have we didn't follow previously, and we haven't followed yet. And hopefully one day we will, because it is pretty ironic when you think that we in the legislative branch actually control the salaries for a independent branch of government. We need to have a system that's set up that allows them to have adequate, reasonable, justifiable compensation. You've heard the numbers as to how we are affixed in our state and how that compares to other states. And clearly one of the branches of government that I think the people really, really do need and appreciate and have to have are qualified individuals serving as judges. And clearly when an individual has to make a decision, many of them based on their personal needs for their families, for themselves and others, they may choose not to lend their services as a judge because they just can't financially afford it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Roblin.
And thank you. And following Senate District 4, Senate District 5, Arnie Roblin on the coast. And, you know, this has been an issue, and I've had friends in the judicial for a long, long time. And I think we need to eventually figure out how to not have this go on. And the testimony you heard before gives you a guided way to get there. And I believe that we should get away that you don't have the judges coming to our branch of government begging for their next salary raise. I it just... bothers me. And having been a high school principal where the appellate courts came and held court in our high school auditorium so kids could get to see what's going on and how the system really works, and all of a sudden there's all these questions. Well, it wasn't like Perry Mason. No, it wasn't. It was a hearing of a course that already took place, and this is an appellate court, and that's why they asked all those questions, and that's why they went back and forth. It was a really great opportunity for us to see those people in action. Having been here now for 12 years, Representative Krieger was kind enough to work some dinners and other kinds of opportunities so we could meet with judges and talk to them in a different setting, so we get to understand that has given me even more appreciation for the time and effort that they are putting in outside of their courtroom to make sure that they develop relationships so that we can have this kind of thing. And I appreciate the work that was done there. I appreciate the opportunity to have conversations with those different judges. And it has become really clear to me that the process we're doing now is not working. And I appreciated what was said before. Whatever we can do to develop a system that just automatically happens so that we can keep our judges paid in an appropriate level. I am always shocked in Oregon that really amazing people step up to do these things, even though they're taking a big financial hit in doing so. We have been very fortunate. I don't know that that will last forever. And because we have been fortunate enough to this point, I don't think we should depend on that, having those kinds of quality people running for those offices and being in those positions for much longer, as the disparity between their rate and what they do in private business grows. So I urge you to think about it. I understand where we're at in the system today, but on this committee, as we go forward, I hope that you continue to look at ways in which we can actually make this program for judicial pay a more stable and better one. So thank you for the opportunity to speak, and any questions you might have.
Representative Krieger.
Senator Roebling, you failed to inform them that that was Krieger's dating service.
Oh, that's right. I didn't want people to misunderstand that dating service.
That's what it was called.
I guess it was.
140 people took place, and we intentionally got Judge Brewer and Dominguez out with some people in the Ways and Means Committee, where it was a one-on-one, and they built a relationship of trust.
And I really appreciate it. That's the kind of thing that we need to do more of in the building. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing that needs to lead to the making these kinds of things right. So I appreciate that.
And just to clarify, really what you're saying is that Krieger's dating service is something that we should be doing more
of. It was a good program, and I don't know why he stopped. I don't know what it was that in the matching that he did that caused him to have a pause, but... yeah, it was a good dating service.
FBI was investigating.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, both.
Thank you.
And the last folks for the last panel would be Chief Justice Ballmer and Judge Mooney.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and members. I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. And with me today is Judge Jody Mooney, Lane County Circuit Judge and President of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. And I'd really like to thank Representatives Olson and Davis, Senators Krasanski and Roblin for speaking in favor of or speaking up about judicial compensation today. Both parties, both houses, that's the kind of support we have. It's been important to us. And we're here to talk just a little bit again about compensation. I don't want to belabor the points that we've made before, but I do appreciate the co-chairs agreeing to hold this hearing. How the state compensates judges is really an important topic for both of our branches of government and for anyone who cares about the quality of justice in Oregon. That's why it's been my top priority this session. It will continue to be. And I'd like to also thank the subcommittee members who signed a letter of support for HB 4145 this session. We had 46 legislators from both parties, both houses. We hope that having this level of support from all four caucuses would contribute in some way to finding areas of agreement between the chambers and caucuses this legislative session. A little kumbaya moment that we were trying to make happen. And we're still so hopeful that we can make some progress in that direction. Oregon's problems with judicial compensation have really been decades in the making, and we're not going to solve them overnight. House Bill 4145 was intended to move us to a point over a number of years that would allow us not to come before you every session like this. The legislature passed a cost of living adjustment mechanism last session, and we really appreciate that. The combination of that cost of living adjustment plus the schedule of increases that were included in 4145 would essentially take us to what the POCC, the Public Officials Compensation Commission, recommended in 2008 and would allow us to stay more or less where we ought to be in terms of compensation when you look at judges around the country, state court judges, and when you look at comparably skilled and experienced lawyers in the state of Oregon. By any measure, Oregon state judges are underpaid. There's been reference to the compensation of judges in other states. As of 2015, Oregon was, just in terms of absolute numbers, 45th out of 51. Adjusted for cost of living, we were 50th out of 51. There have been some changes between July 2015 and now, but they leave us about the same and maybe even a little lower than we were as of July, when the last National Center for State Court report, that was its baseline at that point. We're underpaid compared to the recommendation of the POCC in 2008. The POCC in 2008 recommended $132,000 a year for our trial court judges, starting in 2009. Now, 7 years later, that's still more than $5,000 more than what our trial court judges are getting. We're underpaid compared to other Oregon lawyers. The 2011 survey of the Oregon State Bar indicated that the average salary of lawyers throughout the state, and this includes ones that have been practicing for 30 years and those that were, you know, 2 or 3 years out of law school, was about $125,000. The longer people had been practicing, as one would expect, the more they were making. For lawyers in their 40s, it was about $145,000. Lawyers in their 60s, it was about $167,000. And those are 2011 dollars. And finally, when compared to other public sector lawyers, were underpaid. The Chief Justice makes $30,000 less than the Deputy Attorney General. I had that position, Deputy Attorney General, 20 years ago. And at that time, the deputy was paid about what a circuit judge made. Now the top scale for the deputy is this top step in that pay range is $174,000. Our circuit judges are making now, even with the COLA, about $127,000. I know people don't like to talk about numbers, and I shy away from it because these are big numbers for a lot of people in this state. You've grappled with minimum wage. We have serious issues around the state that are subject to important policy discussions, and you've been grappling with that this session. But the fact is, the market is moving in a way that makes it difficult for us to attract and retain the experienced, highly qualified judges that we need. There are more than 100 lawyers at the State Department of Justice that are paid more than our circuit judges. Deputy district attorneys in the major counties, the largest counties, are paid more than our trial judges, more than the chief justice. And you know, legislative counsel, chief deputy, all those people make more than I do. Now, I don't care that much for me. I'm in this job. I took this job knowing what the compensation was. What I have to do as the head of this branch, though, is to keep and attract good lawyers in the middle of their career, not people who are ready to retire. I don't want the people. No, actually, I'll take them if they're good lawyers and will work hard. But frankly,
are you saying you discriminate based on?
I see it as my duty. It's one of my jobs is to try and keep good lawyers on the bench, and to make sure that when those people retire, because face it, we're sort of a baby boomer crowd, and we have people who are now in their 50s and 60s, and some in their early 70s, and if the voters repeal the mandatory retirement age, we might have some more judges in their 70s and 80s. But at this point, the pool that we're looking at, people that are experienced, complex case criminal lawyers, experienced complex case trial lawyers, family law lawyers, to try and get a really good family law lawyer to come and be a judge in Washington County, given what we're paying those folks and what they're making in the private sector, is very, very tough. So I don't mean to imply that the salaries that the state is paying to the lawyers at DOJ or that Washington County or Multnomah or Clackamas counties are paying to their deputy district attorneys are inappropriate, only that that's the market that we're seeking to draw our good attorneys, our good judges from. And the problem is that the salaries are now lagging so far behind the market for the group of lawyers that we want that the economic sacrifice is simply too great for some of these folks. So last session, as I mentioned, you approved a cost of living adjustment. That was really important. It's going to keep us from sliding too much further behind. But the increases we've had in recent years have just sort of kept us up with inflation and have not addressed the need to pay judges for the importance of the work that they do. So if we could put a schedule of increases in now, the same way that you're trying to do on the minimum wage. We can't bite off the whole amount at once, and that's why we propose some increases over time. That would demonstrate to our current judges and to those who are thinking of becoming judges that the legislature is committed to dealing with this problem. We asked for four increases. If we could put in two or three, if four doesn't make sense or is not possible at this point, that would still be some sort of indication to our current judges and to those that we're hoping will become judges as we look forward. And even if we can't do the increases, the schedule of increases, perhaps we could at least agree on a policy, which we put into our bill, HB 4145, that Oregon should pay its judges the median salary of similar judges in comparable states as the POCC recommended almost 10 years ago. So in summary, Mr. Co-Chairs, it's not a comfortable position to come here and ask for a raise. It can sound self-serving, and I know that we're in competition with many other needs. There's a limited amount of resources and an almost unlimited number of people and organizations and branches of government or agencies asking for money. But we do need judges who can help people who can't afford a lawyer to solve the highly emotional child custody cases that come before them with wisdom and compassion, to face the victims of crime and create a sense and a reality of justice in criminal cases, and to be able to interpret and apply complex contract provisions for cases that we've got involving major corporations or class actions, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. We have to have people who have experience as lawyers and have the maturity and intellect and hard work attitude to be our judges. So I close by asking you not just to think about the cost of having these highly qualified judges on the bench, but what it would cost not to have them. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Judge Moody.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shields and Rayfield and other members of the subcommittee. My name is Jody Mooney. I'm a circuit court judge in Lane County. I'm the current president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association, so obviously I'm here today also to speak in behalf of 4145. I'm going to try not to repeat what's already been said, and you have my written testimony, but I want to just emphasize a couple of things, and part of that is the work that that we do as your trial court judges. So Oregon's trial court judges serves people from all walks of life in every county of this state. We make the child custody decisions. Sometimes we make those decisions on an urgent basis. We make those hard calls on tenant-landlord disputes. We make the calls on foreclosure cases. We preside over small claims cases and medical malpractice cases. We preside over jury and non-jury trials. We assign search warrants day in and day out. We review probable cause determinations made by police officers. That's just kind of the in-the-trench work of your trial court judges. And in order to get that work done, you do need to have lawyers step up to the plate to become judges who have a broad base of experience. A broad base of experience on the bench ensures that you have judges who are competent on the subject matter over which they have authority and preside. Very important, very important. It's also important that we have judges with enough experience to command the level of respect that you need in order to run a courtroom to get the job done. it's also important that we have the level of experience to command the level of respect necessary to have people actually comply with the orders and decisions of the court. It's very important. Ordinary citizens in this state experience the justice system through the judges that they interact with when they come to court. The decision about whether or not to take your dispute to court or to take it to the streets depends upon having an intelligent and strong judiciary. It's already been said that 100 lawyers in the Department of Justice earn more than the trial judges they appear before. What I would like to convey is that many of us believe that the pay disparity actually has an impact on the dynamic in the courtroom. I suspect that many of the lawyers behind me, who I believe are here for to speak for public defenders, would agree with that statement. It's difficult sometimes to describe that in words for people, but you know it when you see it. It's apparent in the courtroom. Passing 4145 as written will reinforce the importance of the work of the judges of the state, which in turn will reinforce the importance of the work of the courts and have a more positive impact on that dynamic in the courtroom. HB 4145, I will tell you, was carefully crafted. It wasn't padded. It's not an inflated request. In fact, it reflects the prudent and responsible sort of budgeting perspective for what I would submit is a small part of the overall state's budget. I would ask you not to reduce the dollar amounts that are listed in the bill, and I would ask you not to lengthen the periods of time over which the requested increases are made. Extending the time periods and or reducing the numbers would likely result in us losing our more senior judges, and that would be a shame to lose that experience on the bench. I've had emails from judges who are approaching their 20th year on the bench who have said if the increases requested this time don't pass, they will step down and join the mediation industry so that they can earn some real money before they really retire. HB 4145 already does represent a carefully considered phase-in of increases that will get Oregon judges to the median point in a reasonable amount of time. It is a bill that has widespread support from both chambers and both parties, precisely because judicial compensation is a nonpartisan administrative funding issue. There's nothing controversial about providing adequate compensation for Oregon's judges because there's nothing controversial about providing adequate funding for a justice system that meets the needs of Oregonians day in and day out. I would share with you a letter that I believe has been presented now to Representative Rayfield. This is a letter written by a lawyer in Washington County, Steve Mia, who actually was selected by his peers as somebody to lobby to put his name in to become a judge. He did that back in 2011. He was sort of, drawn by the call of public service. And he says here, like many attorneys, I was drawn by the call for public service and honored to think that others might see me as a qualified candidate for such an important position. I went through the process and, to my own surprise, was ultimately selected to fill the vacancy by then-Governor Kitzhaber in 2011. Unfortunately, one of the factors I had to seriously consider was compensation. My practice had afforded my family options and advantages that I did not enjoy when I was a child, so I felt obliged to carefully examine the salary and benefits paid to judges in Oregon. Sadly, I came to the harsh conclusion that it would have been a financial mistake for me to accept the position at that time, and I declined the appointment. I was saddened to have to choose between being a responsible husband and father on the one hand and being a circuit court judge on the other hand. And this is the reality of what we're facing based upon the compensation package that's currently in place. The salary increases reflected in the bill offer compensation levels that will do two things. Number one, they will allow the best lawyers, like Mr. Mia, to seriously consider turning to public service work as judges. And number two, allow Oregon's most experienced judges to remain on the bench longer as they contemplate retirement. We appreciate your support, all of you. I think I'm probably preaching sort of to the choir, so we appreciate your support. We really do. What I would ask you to do today is to consider the level of responsibility that judges take every day. And when you do that, I hope that you will ask your leadership to keep an open mind, even at this late stage of the session, and fund this bill as requested. Thank you.
Thank you both. Are there any questions? All right, seeing no questions, thank you again. I also think that just for, it should be noted that there are two people in this room that have put a tremendous amount of work behind the scenes, and that's Mr. Lemon over there, and also Kevin Campbell, who has persistently annoyed, I think, every legislator in the best possible way, both of you guys have, in support of this. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on the judicial compensation. We will keep the informational hearing open on the Public Defense Services Commission. And with that, we'll bring up Nancy Cozine, Executive Director of the Public Defense Services.
Can I come up again?
I was just going to say, the one thing I didn't say was that when you were giving all of the statistics on what attorneys make, I was looking right behind, you know, for a lot of the public defenders right. saying, holy moly, you're making the case for this right here.
That's right. So, that's right. Mr. Co-Chairs, let me just state very briefly that the way the judicial branch is, Tom Ballmer, I'm Chief Justice. And with me is Nancy Cozine, who's the Executive Director of the Public Office of Public Defense Services or Public Defense Services Commission. The Public Defense Services Commission, as some of you know, was set up to take public defense decisions out of the judicial, the Oregon judicial branch. So technically, they are part of the judicial branch, but not under my direct control as the Chief Justice of the Oregon Judicial Department. Their budget does come in as part of the judicial branch's budget. And I did want to just briefly introduce this because this issue of salary need and disparity that we've talked about in terms of judicial compensation applies as well in connection with public defense services. And I'm not sure quite what to make of the fact that we have this dramatic disparity both on the judge side and also on the public defense services side. But I think you can think about that disparity and why it's within the judicial branch, these two parts of it, that we're seeing a lot of disparity that we don't see in other areas of state government, frankly. You heard about a compensation for judges. You'll hear about the public defense system. Many of the same arguments apply here, particularly the comparables. You know, in real estate agency, we talk about the comps. What are similarly situated people? And I think that the comps that that Nancy will talk about will make the case for some adjustments there. How compensation affects quality, also a really important issue for us in the courts, both as I look at it as a judge and as Chief Justice with some responsibility for the overall system. And, as we talked about with the judges, the need to attract and retain qualified people for the job. I can personally speak to the high quality of representation that OPDS attorneys provide in the appellate courts. We have increasingly complex criminal cases. They and their colleagues and the private contractors that we have throughout the state handle those cases very effectively, cost-effectively, and very well. The level of collaboration that we have in this state is really quite remarkable, and Nancy will talk about some of the disparity that we see, an increasing disparity between how we are funding our public defenders and how we fund, also appropriately and a necessary part of our system, the deputy district attorneys who are the prosecutors in these cases, as well as the appellate division of the State Justice Department.
Co-Chair Rayfield, thank you, Chief Justice Ballmer, so much. I'm going to move over a little bit. Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Shields, members of the subcommittee, I had intended to give you an overview of the public defense system. We also have, though, providers here from Multnomah and Benton counties who traveled. I'm wondering if you, I'm wondering if you want to hear from them first, since I am here every day. I don't want to take up the committee's time if we are short on time, and I wasn't just wanted to check in.
Yeah, we have about 25 minutes, so why don't we go ahead? I'll take your advice on that, and we'll start off in Benton County, the chair's perspective on that, where we'll start off. I call up Jennifer Nash and Josh Hunking.
Are you exhibiting a geographic bias?
There could be geographic bias.
That's what I wonder.
Perhaps. So,
okay, and just state your names and begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Nash. I am an attorney in Corvallis.
My name is Josh Hunking. I'm also attorney in Corvallis.
And I had planned to deliver my remarks after Ms. Cosine, so I'll have to explain a little more than I had anticipated about some of the numbers. But let me tell you a little bit about me and about my practice. I am the administrator of the Benton County Defense Consortium. So because you haven't had the overview of what that means, I'll explain to you. There are three types of public defense lawyers in the trial division in Oregon. There are public defenders who are nonprofit public defenders, full-time employees of a nonprofit public defender association. There are consortia attorneys and law firms who are private lawyers who take court-appointed cases as part of their practice. And then there are hourly trial lawyers who take cases, public defense cases, on an hourly basis. I am the administrator of a consortium who has 11 members at this point. We went from 8 to 11 members this year to deal with caseload concerns. And each of us are in private practice, and we take private cases as well as court-appointed cases. Our particular practice, I have a law partner who's here with me today, Nicholas Ortiz. We there are two lawyers in our firm. We are both graduates of Oregon law schools. I went to the University of Oregon and graduated in 1996. I have $70,000 in student loan debt as of today. That's a combination of undergraduate debt and law school debt. Mr. Ortiz graduated in 1998, and he did not have any undergraduate debt, but still has $50,000 in student loan debt that we're paying. We have three staff members in our office, two legal assistants, and one administrative assistant who deals with the administrative work for the court and the consortium in appointing court-appointed attorneys to cases. Our hourly rate to run our practice is $63 per lawyer per hour. So to keep the lights on, pay our staff, pay all of our bills, we have to make $63 each in order to do that, and that's without our salaries. That's just our overhead minus our salaries. 66% of our income is derived from public defense cases, and the remainder is from private retained cases.
Ms. Nash, how you calculate the $63? Is that 8
income.
Hours a day, 40 hours a week?
Yes, I'm sorry, 40 okay. hours a week, yes. Of course,
and
we all know that doesn't happen.
8 hours a day?
No.
Okay.
We do not, yes, and I do not work 40 hours a week. I don't know if I've ever worked 40 hours a week, but I certainly am not working 40 hours a week now. But that is calculated based on 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. So 2/3 of our practice is public defense cases, 34% privately retained cases. And as I mentioned, unlike nonprofit public defender offices, we pay all of our own overhead. And also, there are 11 lawyers in 10 offices, some office share. But each of those are paying their own rent, their own assistance, their own PLF. So we don't have the ability, because of conflict situations, to really pool those resources. So for the money that we receive for public defense cases, we're paying all of our own overheads individually. Compensation for public defense cases is outrageously low. My law partner is currently appointed on a capital murder case where the defendant is facing a death sentence, and he receives $70 an hour for his work, and that's a deviation from the usual rate of $46 an hour. The state could not find an attorney for that case at $46 an hour, so they had to pay a premium of $70 an hour. For
You haven't seen the chart yet that Ms. Cozine will present about what the most common contracted rates are for consortia cases. In Benton County, we actually don't receive those rates. For some inexplicable reason, our case rate is on average 6% lower than the common case rate, despite the fact that Benton County has the highest cost of living outside the Tri-County area. In Benton County, we're compensated, wait for it, $342 for a DUII case. So I urge you to think about a loved one who has $342 to spend on hiring an attorney for a DUII and see if they are able to do that. Yet that's how much we're paid for appointment in those cases. Low case rates lead to caseloads that compromise quality. And in our situation, our retained casework, our private work, subsidizes our public defense work, but we're being squeezed on both ends. We can't take more public defense cases because they don't pay enough, and we can't take more private cases because our caseload for our public cases, our public defense cases, don't allow us to do that and provide the kind of quality representation that we need to and want to provide to our clients. Everyone in this room has a commitment to public service and a commitment to the common good, and that's why we do this work. But we need to be compensated fairly for the work that we're doing, despite the fact that we are doing it for our, because we have a commitment to public service. It's extremely difficult to attract new and energetic young lawyers to this endeavor because they don't get paid enough to be able to maintain a practice. And I told you how much our law school debt is. That's not what law school debt is coming out of law school now. It's significantly higher, and it's extremely difficult to maintain and attract quality lawyers to public interest law because there's just not enough money to be able to do the kind of work that they would like to do and pay their cost of just running their households and running a law practice. And with that, I brought with me Mr. Hunking, who is a new member of our consortium as of January. He is a recent graduate from Willamette Law School, and he can speak directly to that issue. I thank you for your time. If you have, unless you have other questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hunking.
And maybe before you turn it over, the one thing you had mentioned that you can't take more private cases, because obviously even if you're getting paid the premium of $70 an hour, that's $7 an hour over your $63.
Right.
It's not much of a salary. So obviously you're trying to offset that with the private cases, but you can't take as much private cases as you would like to. Why? Is there a structural issue, or is it just caseload in providing quality, like kind of an internal guide?
Well, it's both, really. So, I mean, there are only so many cases that you can have where you can effectively represent people and do the kind of work that you need to do that. So, structurally, I think the problem that exists in this system is that because the case rates are so low, it requires attorneys to take a volume of cases that perhaps can be too high in order to provide the kind of quality representation that's needed. And how that plays in with the private cases, it's that, you know, if you take a public defense case or you take a private case, you should be doing the exact same amount of work. And so if you have a caseload that, you know, if you take one more private case, you can't do the work. If you take one more public case, you can't do the work. And in terms of the, you know, the exact number, I don't have an exact number for you. I can tell you that Paul Levy, who is legal counsel for the Office of Public Defense Services, says for some lawyers, one case is one case too many. So it really just depends on your your staffing levels, your level of technological savvy, your organizational skills, all sorts of things. But for us, at this point, I'm not taking any new privately retained domestic cases because my caseload for my criminal cases and my domestic cases is too much. So I've been turning new clients away for, I think, almost 3 months now because I'm just unable to maintain the level of commitment and the level of quality representation that I should be.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One question then. Are you able to afford an investigator?
Good question.
Thank you.
So the investigator, and Ms. Cosine would have talked about this, and we'll talk about this, investigator is paid separately. Oh. So we don't have to pay for investigators, expert witnesses, things like that out of those funds. Those are paid separately through the Office of Public Defense Services Commission.
And thank you for that. What about, too, any sort of scientific, like crime lab sorts of
things?
Same thing, so it's out of a separate fund?
Yes, those are all paid separately through a request that's made directly to the Office of Public Defense Services, and they fund those separately.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right. Please. Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Shields, Josh Hunking. I'm an attorney out of Corvallis, other members of the committee. I will be as brief as possible. I think my most valuable contribution to this informational hearing here today is to provide my perspective as a young lawyer just joining. I graduated from Willamette in 2013, took the bar and began practicing in October of 2013. During law school, I received $30,000 worth of scholarships from the school, as well as about $40,000 from the National Guard. Currently, I have, as of this morning, a little over $138,000 remaining in student loan debt. All of that is from law school, and I've paid about $20,000 towards that debt since graduating. I was asked why join and why provide criminal defense services in this format here, and really the value to me is to give me experience, courtroom experience, and experience with clients, as well as providing me with associations with the other lawyers in the community, providing my office some credibility, as well as providing a regular source of income, which is valuable for me to mitigate some of the cash flow risks in running a law practice. Thinking about it further, though, I recognize that all of those goals will be accomplished in the next couple of years. After 3 to 5 years goes by, there's the incentives for me to continue to do this work disappear, and I will likely not continue doing the work. But thank you for your time. If you have any questions to me, I'm available.
Did you tell Ms. Nash that before you came here today?
We're not surprised, though. That's part of why we're here. I mean, that is exactly the issue that I spoke of, and that is that it's very difficult to maintain and retain quality attorneys at the rates that are being paid, because the truth is Mr. Hunking can make a lot more money doing privately retained cases than he ever can doing public defense cases, and it's just not economically viable, especially with the amount of student loan debt that he has to pay.
Any other questions? All right, seeing that, thank you both very much. We have one other panel to call up, and I think what we'll do is we'll call up two at a time. We have Mark McKechnie, maybe, if I pronounce that correctly, and then Eric Dietrich. Please begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Rayfield and Shields and members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie, and I've been the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice for 8 years now. Youth Rights and Justice has had contracts to provide public defense services in the juvenile court system for virtually all of our history of 41 years, including contracting with Multnomah County and then later with the state of Oregon. We're the largest and oldest law firm, a nonprofit law firm dedicated to serving court-appointed clients in the juvenile court system. I've had the opportunity to talk with all of you sometimes, many times in the past, over going back about 10 years in some cases, and I'm frankly going to say some of the same things today that I've been saying in past sessions, because in spite of good intentions, I think we've made very little measurable progress on the issues of either pay disparities or caseload, high caseloads for attorneys who represent children, youth, and parents in the juvenile court system. Someone has magically made the chart I submitted appear on the screen so you can see. This is, as of last July, looking at three data points for comparing our attorneys and their salary levels, starting salaries at 8 years and salaries after 17 years. And you can see that the disparity is significant to start, and it grows over time. One of the things that this chart doesn't show that I think it's important to point out is that it's only after about 10 years of practice that one of our attorneys will reach a salary that's equivalent of the starting salary of an assistant district attorney. So after handling ballpark over 1,000 cases, at that point will one of our attorneys reach the salary level of an assistant prosecutor on their first day of work.
Is that just Multnomah County, or is that...
This is because Representative Barker, Co-Chair Rayfield, these salaries for district attorneys are specific county to county, it's really only appropriate to compare our salaries with the local Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. It may be different in other counties.
Thank you.
There are a number of structural issues that contribute to this problem, both the salary disparity and unreasonable caseloads. For us, as has been explained, these issues are two sides of the same coin. We're paid by the case. We're not paid based on our staffing or other factors. So we are in a position faced with inadequate resources where we have to try to balance and create a situation where our salaries are just high enough to retain good people, and our caseloads are just low enough to also retain good people, where they feel their workload is manageable, and it's a constant struggle. And I would add, there's always a moment every 2 years I've signed 4 2-year contracts in my tenure, and I always have a moment where I tell myself, I shouldn't sign this. I would actually be doing a service in the long run to some of the people who I employ not to accept the terms of this contract, because they're so difficult for us to meet with the resources they provide. The American Bar has said that juvenile caseloads should be range from 60 clients to no more than 80 clients at one time, and our attorneys consistently carry more than 80 cases at one time, and some of those cases involve multiple clients because we represent sibling groups in dependency cases. So it's not unusual for our full-time attorneys to represent 90 to 100 clients at one time, well above the ABA standards. The Oregon Bar has also set ambitious and high standards for the representation of clients in juvenile court. But with these size caseloads, we're running the risk as a state that the interests of those individual clients come in conflict with one another because of the very real limits on the attorney's time and attention that they can pay to each of their clients' interests and needs. And our attorneys have very few choices. They can fail to meet some of those obligations to individual clients, which they don't do, or what they do instead is they work additional time, evenings and weekends, on a regular basis to make sure that they are fulfilling their duty to each client. We know from experiences in other states, the experiences in Washington State have been discussed in committee more than once previously, and we have evidence that clearly shows that reasonable caseloads in juvenile cases make a real difference in the lives of the people who are served in those cases. When we have higher caseloads, fewer families are reunited. There are more children in foster care, and they stay longer. And the longer they stay in care, I think it's become exceptionally apparent at this time that the risk to their well-being grows the longer they spend time in our foster care system. And it also costs the state more money to keep more children in foster care. We see fewer adoptions and guardianships, and they take longer to achieve when there aren't enough attorneys and resources in the juvenile court system to handle the current workload. In Oregon, over a quarter of children in foster care have been in care for 3 years or longer, and half of them have experienced more than 4 foster placements. The juvenile court system is ultimately the place where decisions are made about which children come into foster care, how long they stay in foster care, and in what manner they leave the foster care system, whether they go home to their parents, whether they're adopted or placed in a guardianship, or whether they languish in foster care and ultimately age out when they become adults.
Mr. McKitchen, we're supposed to adjourn at 30 past, but we're going to go a little bit longer. And so if we could, I want to make sure I have time to get to everyone on who made the time to come down here today.
Sure. So, yeah. Thank you. I'm just wrapping up. So investing in adequate resources in our public defense system pays dividends in terms of benefiting the clients who are served by the public defense system and pays dividends for taxpayers and better outcomes and lowering costs in other ways over time. You'll be receiving recommendations in the future from the Governor's Task Force on Dependency Representation, and I look forward to continuing this conversation with this subcommittee at that time. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Dietrich.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Eric Dietrich. I work at Multnomah Defenders, which is a nonprofit public defender in Portland. I was here in a similar manner 3 years ago when there was a bill in front of the legislature requiring pay parity. The bill failed, but this committee specifically did authorize a policy option package that meant a lot to my colleagues and my family, so I wanted to thank this committee for doing that in 2013. But looking at the chart, you can see we're still kind of in the same spot. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the flip side to the funding disparities that exist, which is the excessive caseloads. Because we get paid structurally per case and we get paid so little per case, attorneys and law firms take on more cases than they should. The economic model requires them to do so. 2 years ago, as part of a work group put together by the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association to look at our economic model, look at our funding system, we looked at a lot of data. What we discovered was that in 2013, the state contracted out with public defender providers to provide defense at about 156,000 cases statewide. We then looked at those case numbers by specific case types and compared those to national caseload standards. What we discovered was, frankly, it was painful, that we currently fund, based on our contracts, about 468 full-time attorneys to provide public defense services, and those caseload models suggested we needed 767. So we're funding about 300 fewer attorneys than we need to cover the caseloads, and that's assuming that everyone was working at maximum caseload standards. Basically, we're funding 60% of the attorneys we need. In the same year we did that work group, to the north in the state of Washington, there was a federal lawsuit involving two municipalities who had public defender caseloads that were excessive. And it was the Wilbur versus the city of Mount Vernon. And the federal judge found in those two municipalities' public defender systems that the right to counsel had basically become meaningless based on the number of cases they had, and ordered remedies. In response, the state of Washington adopted rigid caseload standards. They our limits on how many cases a public defender can do: 300 misdemeanors a year, 150 felonies a year, 80 juvenile dependency child welfare cases. Those provide standards so that A, those people get meaningful representation, and B, attorneys don't burn out quick. I mean, it's a real problem. You know, with mounting student loan debt, mounting caseloads, and you're looking at data like these charts, people just quit. And then we have to retrain everyone all over again. So, you know, my takeaway for this committee, I wanted to bring to your attention, is I know that, you know, we know the DA's salary is here, and we know that our salary is here. But just understand that we've only gotten this close by taking on caseloads that exceed national standards. If we actually were doing national standards, I mean, the disparity would be significantly worse. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Worsley.
I just have one question that kind of relates to this, and that is, I know that we tell people that they have the right to an attorney, and if they cannot afford one, we'll appoint them one at no expense. And yet I know that we charge them a substantial amount. In fact, I think every state now charges substantial fees. Do those fees go into supporting the public defenders?
Co-Chair Shields and Rayfield and Representative Gorsuch, I will defer to Ms. Cozine, who I see reaching the table.
Co-Chairs, Representative Gorsuch, the way that fees are imposed, there are two different ways, actually. There's something called the Application Contribution Program. That is a judgment that is issued at the front end of a case, and the applicant can be charged a $20 application fee. They can also be charged a contribution amount. That amount is actually then goes into what we call the ACP account, the Application Contribution Program. And the ACP account is available for funding court verification specialists, so the people who verify people's eligibility, and some functions at our office. Those are other funds, and we operate with relatively little in the way of other funds. The court is also able to impose a recoupment amount at the end of the case. Mm-hmm. Recoupment amounts actually go into the general fund and can be appropriated by the legislature, how the legislature sees fit.
So what you're saying is, even though when I was in law enforcement and gave a Miranda warning that said you would be provided an attorney without cost, we're really not doing that, are we?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Gorsuch, I'd like to take the fifth.
Okay. I understand that fully.
We are, we do, we do, we do appoint, the court appoints counsel, and we thankfully have dedicated judges and lawyers who do this work. Judges can waive the application fee, they can waive all fees, they aren't required to impose. Mm-hmm. In fact, there is quite a bit of litigation around whether or not the imposition of fees is appropriate when someone is unable to pay. But you point up, you bring up a good issue, which is that many people have very limited means.
Thank you. Sarah Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, it's pretty obvious that the disparity is often because you've got apples and oranges when it comes to funding sources. So the counties pay for their local DAs, and then the state pays for the defense of those who are accused. It seems to me that at some point the legislature might want to take a look at bringing all the DA's salaries under the state budget so that we could then have some parity there. And I'll work on that in my last couple of minutes.
Representative Barton.
I don't know where we get any more money to do any of that, but yeah. I just would point out.
The counties would like it.
Though. Friends in, in Louisiana, and just maybe within the last month, the public defender in New Orleans just said, I'm done. We're not going to defend any important cases because I can't. And if you've never seen Louisiana, if you think Major 11 is draconian, you need to go to Louisiana, where the average sentence going into Angola prison is 88 years. In the case of the militants up in Malheur County, when the police shot Leroy, everybody in that car would be facing life without parole for murder because somebody got killed in the commission of a crime. So, I mean, it's, and down there they need, you know, and they're underpaid as well. I mean, you guys are very badly underpaid as well, but it's just horrific. It isn't just an Oregon issue.
Yeah.
But it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, thank you both. We have two more folks to testify. We are over time, so I'd ask you to be somewhat brief, but we have Valerie Roan and Grant Hartley. Come on in.
Chair, and co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Lane Borg. I'm the executive director of Metropolitan Public Defenders and happily the employers of the two lawyers you're going to hear from. I'm just here to officially introduce the exhibit that's on the chart, and I'll be leaving with you a similar one that shows the disparity between the investigators in my office. And the investigator that we chose to compare, the public employee investigator, is the Independent Police Commission for the City of Portland's complaint investigator. And why that is relevant is that not only is the job description the same as my investigators, but the woman who does the job used to be one of my investigators. And you'll see even from there is no overlap. They're paid thousands and thousands of dollars more. And I'll leave those charts with them. And with that, introduce my two hardworking lawyers to tell their stories.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Grant Hartley, and I'm proud to be a public defender. I'm currently employed at Metropolitan Public Defender as a misdemeanor attorney. I graduated from the University of Oregon Law School in 2014, and much like many of the people you've heard from and many of my classmates, I graduated with a significant amount of debt. And I was asked to speak to you today about the impact that pay disparity has had on my life, and that impact is significant. Due to student loans and compensation I receive, I've had to put many major life steps on hold, including getting married, starting a family, buying a home. However, The issue of pay disparity is about far more than its effects on us individual attorneys. It's also about the effects on the thousands of people that we represent. These are thousands of people that rely on a public defender every day to help guide them through a frightening and intimidating system, to help protect their rights, and to vigorously advocate for them. Unfortunately, the sheer volume of clients that we represent makes that advocacy difficult. It requires long hours, strong work ethic, thick skin, and patience, lots of patience. It also requires that we build a relationship of trust with our clients, and that trust, however, is often undermined by the perception that somehow public defenders are inferior to their counterparts at the district attorney's office. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from clients ask me how much longer I have to work at the PD's office before I get to go to the DA's office, or accuse me of working with the district attorney's office to secure a future position. Part of that perception is the result of the constant churn of young attorneys both in and out of the public defender's office. Unlike the DA's office, where compensation continues to increase as you climb the ladder, in the public defender's office, there's very little opportunity for upward mobility, at least as far as compensation goes, as the graph shows. Thus, while the DA's office provides a lucrative lifelong career path, attorneys that want to dedicate their lives to public defense are forced to make significant financial sacrifices in order to do the work that they love. However, the majority of those attorneys end up leaving, and they do so because those sacrifices simply become too great. And that leaves a vacuum of experience and knowledge at the office, which has a very detrimental effect on the clients that we represent. I will inevitably have to face that decision myself, and I dread that day. I absolutely love the work that I do. I haven't been doing it that long, but I can't imagine doing anything else. But at the same time, I need to look out for my future and my future family. But what is truly hard to swallow about this whole thing is the fact that these sacrifices are only being asked of one side of the aisle. That is why we're here today. You have the power to correct this imbalance. So I leave you with the fact that justice requires a level playing field, and it simply can't occur when one side is valued more than the other. So on behalf of my colleagues and my clients, I ask you to please support pay parity. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Shields, other members of the committee, my name is Valerie Roan. I am a staff attorney at Metropolitan Public Defender in Multnomah County. I'm in the major felony unit. I've been there an attorney for about 3 years. I graduated from law school in 2012 from Chapman University in Orange County, California. Not many people can say that they love what they do, and not many people can say they do what they love. I get to say that I do both. My work is my passion, and my passion is my work. I love being a public defender, and I love it because it gives me hope. It gives me hope that there are other people that care about other people for the sake of being humans. It gives me hope that the most oppressed and vulnerable members of our society have hardworking, good, dedicated people like the ones here today that are going to stand up and fight for their rights and fight for them. A lot of these people have never had anybody to fight for them in their lives. This was my dream job, it is my dream job, and I get to live it so early on in my career. But the hope I have and the dream I'm living when I'm at work ends when I walk out of work. It ends when I walk inside my house and I see that my husband's there. While I have dreamt of this career my entire life, I've also dreamt of having a family, of having children and being a mother. I never expected to have to make the choice between the two. I'm currently in debt, $245,900.77. That is all from my law school student debt. That is law school that was fixed from the federal government and interest rates that are put on me from the federal government. I pay $1,200 a month in my student loans, and I pay my payments religiously. I'm not even making a debt on the interest. My husband works full-time as a welder, and we live paycheck to paycheck, and sometimes we have to borrow money from our parents. My husband and I have looked at every angle, and we've unturned every rock, and each time we've come up short, and we've made the decision that we simply cannot afford children. The income that I make as a public defender, the profession that I love, is keeping me from becoming a mother. Every year that goes by, I reevaluate my situation and make a decision whether or not I give up my passion for this cause and seek a family, or I keep fighting for what I believe in and give up the hope of ever becoming a mom. I sincerely doubt the district attorney's office and the district attorneys that I work with every single day, all day long, have to make that same choice. And I'm asking that you take that into consideration and you support the pay parity between them. Thank you.
Thank you both. Are there any questions? Yes,
I just want to say something really quick. You're grossly underpaid, and my idea of pay parity is to pull you up, not to have an amalgamation and pull somebody else down. DAs are underpaid as well as attorneys in the system. And so I don't know how we'll do it, but my goal would be to lift you up, not to pull somebody else down.
Yeah. Representative Gorsuch.
I concur with Representative Barker. And I agree with what's been said, that you can't have justice if the playing field is so uneven. And even though I'm coming from the law enforcement side, I firmly believe that you cannot operate a system without adequate defense as well as proper, properly funded district attorney. So I fully agree. We need to.
Can't put him in prison without him.
No, oh, he doesn't mean it that way, though.
Coming from the police.
Yeah.
Senator Shields, would you like to balance these comments out?
Yes, please do, because we are unbalanced.
I think I'll refrain.
All right. So with that, thank you very much.
I'm going to comment after this hearing on a different subject.
We're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing. Representative Barker.
Thank you. I just want to put on the record, chairs, that there's somebody trying to promote cardboard pallets. And this has been going on in the building, and they apparently weren't getting anywhere. And I was surprised that, since we do the prison budgets, to see that a press release on Monday from Tim Perry with the Challenge of Pallet, and he said that they're going to have some prisons would be using cardboard pallets next year. The Department of Corrections pilot program is ordered by Governor Kate Brown, etc. I checked with the governor's office. That is not true at all. The governor, they inquired of the governor's office. The governor's office said we'd be open to hearing something. But so this is actually a very false statement. I think they're trying to do fait accompli that they're going to do that. And then also so they can go to other states and say, gee, Oregon's prison system is doing this, so should you. But that is not the case. And we're not spending any extra money, taking money from mental health or something in corrections to buy cardboard pallets. So I just want to put that on record. Thank you.
My understanding as well. And with that,
I cheated for so long.
Yeah.
I think we should look over to Senator Shields
and thank
him for his service. So if this is our last subcommittee meeting.
Yeah, I guess there's a chance we might meet during the interim. But
that is true.
But it has been an honor and a privilege to work with you all. And
I think we've had a dozen years together.
Yeah, it's been a good run. Thank you.
Thank you for your years of service.
And with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.